and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne, and on this edition, a court has blocked Italy's plan to send asylum seekers to Albania, disrupting Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's main migration policy and raising questions about what's next. Dockers have been locked out of the port of Montreal after they reject their latest pay offer.
We work 19 days in 21 days period. We are available for work. It could not continue like this. We are in 2024.
And we'll speak to one man who's riding the waves of retirement, quite literally. And if you want to contact us on any of those stories, you can get in touch on WhatsApp or send us a voice note on 0044 330 678 3033, or you can email us anytime on world.business@bbc.co.uk. But first, let's start with a big setback for Italy's migration plan. An Italian judge has rejected Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's attempt to detain asylum seekers in Albania. Now, this is a story we've been following here on World Business Report for a while. The Italian government had struck a deal with Albania to send Europe-bound migrants there. Here is the Prime Minister speaking earlier this week.
There was a bit of concern about the issue of safe countries that, according to some governments, are not in a position to define what a safe country is. And so you risk being faced with a reality in which there are no safe countries. This compromises every possibility of governing migration and of stopping illegal mass migration.
Well, today those plans faced an even bigger setback as a court in Rome has ruled that the migrants currently on a ship off the coast of Albania must be returned to Italy. And there's more. The court has now referred the legality of Meloni's plan to the European Court of Justice. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delany has been following the story.
Well, this is an agreement between Italy and Albania that Italy would fund the construction and operation of two centres in Albania, one in the port of Shenzhen, the other one about 20 kilometres down the road in Jadar. And these would deal with the arrival, processing and the accommodation of asylum seekers who want to claim asylum in Italy. But Italy is saying, well, we want to make this whole idea of people making irregular migration routes to Italy less attractive, and this is part of that. So the agreement was made between Italy and Albania. In theory, it can handle up to 3,000 people per month to a maximum of 36,000 people per year, and decisions are meant to be turned around very swiftly, within a month, and people will either then be transferred to Italy for further asylum processing, or they will be repatriated to their home countries from Albania if their asylum claims fail.
So what were the main reasons why the Italian judge rejected the plan?
Well, first and foremost, the Italian tribunal in Rome has said that this is a matter for the European Court of Justice to deal with. This is largely because of the definition of what are known as safe countries. The Italian government's argument is that the countries that this latest group of arrivals in Albania come from, which is to say Egypt and Bangladesh in these cases, they're saying these countries are on our Italian government list of safe countries. Therefore, according to the rules that we've laid down for the people who will be going through these centres in Albania, those people from Egypt and Bangladesh are eligible to go down that route. So the people have to be adult, single male, not vulnerable, and from a so-called safe country. The judges have said once before that Egypt and Bangladesh can't be considered to be safe countries because parts of them have already been ruled unsafe by the European Court. The Italian government responded by making a decree enshrining a list of safe countries in Italian law. This has gone back to the courts in Rome, and once again, the judges have said, this isn't a matter for us, it's a matter for the European Court of Justice, and we want them to refer on this. We want them to rule on this. In the meantime, the people who are currently in Albania must be immediately transferred to Italy.
Guy Delany there. Well, in response to the ruling, Matteo Salvini, Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the Anti-Immigrant League Party, said the decision is another political ruling, not against the government, but against Italians and their security. Earlier today, I spoke to MP Leah Quartapella, who's from the Italian Democratic Party and is Vice Chairman of the Committee on Foreign and European Affairs.
I believe this is an incredible waste of taxpayer money. We are seeing that the scheme in Albania is not working. We're spending a lot of money for people to be sent to Albania and then resent back to Italy. And I don't think this way of wasting taxpayers' money is actually affecting human trafficking. Waste is resources that are much needed to welcome in a dignified way people in Italy, or resources that are needed to prevent people from leaving their countries of origin.
I mean, how is the Italian government justifying it, though, that significant expenditure to the taxpayers, especially considering the broader economic challenges that are in Italy at the moment?
Well, the Albania scheme is the perfect occasion for them to showcase that they would like to do something, but they can't because of Europe, because of the judges, because of somebody else's fault. While we think that it is their fault that's invented a scheme that is completely pointless and will not solve anything, but will just waste the taxpayers' money.
Are the economic benefits really on the side of Albania, because they're actually hosting these facilities? So given the investment and increased responsibilities for them, are they the ones who are actually benefiting?
Well, the people that are benefiting are the people that built the construction works that were done in Albania, the people that are working in Albania, because Italian prison guards and policemen and bureaucrats that work in Albania to do the casework that otherwise would be done in Italy are getting extra money above their salaries, and also Albania. So it is an advantage of very few people, and it is a detriment to the efficiency of the management of migrant system in Italy, which is underfunding and which does not provide with speedy analysis of the cases, nor with money that is needed to welcome these people and to help them learn Italian, learn a job, find a job and settle down in the country.
Now, given the judgment by the Italian judge, that's going to lead to repatriation of the migrants, isn't it? So what are the associated economic costs with the entire process, considering that these people have been deported, but now they're going to have to be brought back?
Well, apparently each trip costs between 15,000 to 20,000 euros per person per trip. So, I mean, this is an incredibly expensive scheme for people that just go to Albania for a couple of days and then get repatriated to Italy just to show that the government is doing something. But really, we would like laws that can be respected and effective ways of managing the flows of people coming through the sea, rather than just wasting money to showcase an intention from the government that does not translate into an action.
Despite this judgment, though, do you think this model could be replicated by other European countries, particularly countries that are trying to shift economic burdens related to migration across borders? Has there been interest from other European countries in what Italy is doing?
Well, there is an interest, but I think actually there was an interest, but I think that after these two cases of people being sent to Albania and then resent to Italy very quickly, the interest is really diminishing. I think we should work much better with European countries in order to get agreements with countries of origins and countries of transit. There you can get a positive effect of being united as Europe in order to control trafficking of human beings.
That was Italian MP Leah Quartapella. All right, let's head to Canada, where operations at the Port of Montreal were significantly reduced on Monday. The Employers Association followed through on its threat to lock out nearly 1,200 longshore workers after they rejected what was called a final contract offer. Earlier today, I spoke to Michael Murray, spokesperson for the Montreal Ports Longshoremen Union.
The employer tell everybody that they give us $200,000. That's not true. That's really not true. To make this amount of money, we have to work at $97 per hour. They offer us $51 in 2029. Then it's not true. It's not about the wage and the salary. It's about the hours of work. It's about the scheduling. It's about the conciliation with work and family.
Can you explain to us what was missing from the deal that makes it untenable for your members? You mentioned scheduling. That seems to be a major sticking point. Can you explain why that's such a critical issue for your members?
It's the first point. The scheduling for the hour of works is the first point for us. To be able to live in work and at the same time, I'll be able to have a life with our family. We work 19 days in 21 days period. We are available for work. It could not continue like this. We are in 2024. We have to change the three who think that with the click of the finger, they're going to have a longshoreman and go to work and work as long as it's possible. We cannot continue like this. And one of the main issues is the respect from this employer. All around the world, you see struggling in the docking industry. The big company around the world think that they could dominate the dockers. We are people who work hard our job, and we find no respect from the Maritime Employer Association here in Montreal. A lot of suspension, 33 people fired from now on in our union. It's not acceptable.
What would the union's solution be to the scheduling and work-life balance issues?
Well, we have some proposition to that we put on the table. The main problem is that the employer refused to go on the negotiation tables since 3 weeks, we run and run after the employer to have a negotiation table. They don't answer us. They put a lockout yesterday night. They said to the government, and that's very special. It's unbelievable. And we need a negotiation table where we would fix the problem of the hours of work for our people and the problem of the company who need people to work and to be sure that the Port of Montreal are going to have a long viability. We sent an email this morning at the employer to say, hey, we fix in a hotel in Montreal, 2 rooms to have the negotiation table going on. We have no response. Till this morning, we asked the employer, are we going to have a negotiation table? No response.
It is a really important port, isn't it? It you know, moves 400 million Canadian dollars worth of goods daily. How do you respond to criticism, though, that this strike is hurting not just the economy, but also everyday Canadians? What would you say to a small business that's worried about losing revenue as we approach the holiday season?
The holidays gift and the holidays thing already on the sheets, already on the tablets, already on the store. And the people who need their container, if they're not going in Montreal, they're going to go in Halifax and they're going to be traveling by train. It's not the only port that we have on the East Coast. You have New York, you have Halifax, you have St. John, New Brunswick. And people say, hey, I'm going to lose a lot of things. No, you're going to receive your merchandise. They are somewhere going in another port to be in the charge. And they're going to arrive 1 day, probably 2 day delay. But everything's going to arrive. We're still going to have bananas. We're still going to have grape. We're still going to have the iPhones already on the tablets. Everything is there.
The Labour Minister, he's stressed the urgency of the situation, hasn't he? Do you think government intervention is needed to reach a resolution?
No, we have big respect for the Minister of Labour. And we saw him 3 weeks ago and we find that he has big respect for the dockers in the Port of Montreal too. What the Minister of Labour said and still say today, go on the negotiation table. The dockers union are ready to go on the negotiation table, but one person missing. The employer refused to go on the negotiation table.
That was Michael Murray, spokesperson for the Montreal Ports Longshoremen Union. We reached out to the Montreal Port Authority for a statement, but we have yet to receive a response. Now, somebody who will respond to me, I know, is Peter Jankowskis, Vice President, Research and Analysis at Arbor Financial Services. Hello, Peter.
Hello there. How are you?
Good. I mean, it feels like it's been a few years of labour disputes, particularly in critical sectors like transportation and logistics. Is it just me or is it just more frequent, really, in this current economic climate?
Well, I think it certainly has picked up ever since the COVID outbreak and the recovery from that, where labour was in very short supply. It certainly has strengthened labour's hand in negotiations, given how tight the labour market has been and continues to be.
Mm. Another thing I want to ask you about is Bitcoin. It surged nearly 14% recently, crossed that $87,000 mark for the first time. I mean, a lot of investors seem to be betting that President-elect Donald Trump's policies could sustain Bitcoin's momentum. But I want to know, what do you think?
I don't know. Bitcoin is inherently volatile. It certainly has surged on these sorts of things in the past. I suspect it's going to fall back somewhat eventually. One, because I don't think the reforms will be as sweeping as many people are imagining right now. And, you know, the Fed is still in a mode of you know, somewhat restrictive policy as well, which I think will have an impact as well.
Because you got people, they're shouting from the rooftop saying it's becoming an alternative to traditional assets like precious metals. Or do you feel like at the moment this is really just a speculative bubble?
I still continue to see it as a speculative bubble, but it certainly continues to move higher as well, as bubbles often do. It has also at times crashed back tremendously as well. So yes, there are some returns to be made here, but investors have to be comfortable with that level of volatility.
Mm. Global oil prices as well is another one for today, fell about 3% recently. Some people pointing to China's disappointing stimulus plans. Or is it really more to do with the strength of the U.S. dollar?
Well, I think both of those are strong factors. Probably with today's drop, the Chinese news is probably the big driver. I think some people also suspect that there might be an increase in supply coming from the U.S. as well, with the Trump administration coming in. So all of those factors would serve to push down the price of crude.
Mm, exactly. Equity markets, particularly the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, they stalled recently, haven't they? I mean, we're still finding out a lot of things in the wash after the post-election rally. But I suppose, was that always going to happen sometimes if something goes up so much of a surge? I mean, it will come down eventually.
Yes, indeed. You know, that's kind of a natural process. And, you know, frankly, the market was up pretty strongly and valued richly before even this run-up. So I think some investors are taking a little bit of a pause here and seeing if they're comfortable with it moving up higher or if we're going to consolidate. I'm feeling we're going to consolidate.
All right. Well, we'll come back to you on that one, Peter. Make sure that you're right. Peter Jankowskis, Vice President, Research and Analysis, Arbor Financial Services. Thank you so much for joining us. And you are with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, last month's devastating floods in Spain's Valencia region killed over 200 people and sparked widespread anger over the authorities' delayed response. But it's also become clear that some businesses were slow to recognise the risks to their workers. The BBC's Stefania Gozer has been investigating the role companies can play in keeping employees safe during natural disasters.
The 29th of October, the day flash floods swept through eastern Spain, many of the people who got caught on the roads were coming out of work and heading home. Weather warnings had been issued since the early morning, and by 8 a.m., the south of the province was on red alert, with the Spanish weather agency asking the public not to leave home unless strictly necessary. Yet companies like the one where Ahmed Sidi Benha works still expected staff to commute to their work centers.
We were never told not to go to work. We started the afternoon shifts as usual at 2 p.m. and by 5 p.m. we had to be evacuated to the factory's first floor. Half an hour later, the river had busted all around us. There was water everywhere. There was no salvation if you tried to get out. The first floor was the only safe space. Cars disappeared as if they were toys. We were uncommunicated, with no electricity, no running water, no food, no signal. At least we had bottled water to drink, but we had to spend the night there.
The floods killed more than 200 people, and dozens are still missing. Many aspects of the circumstances that led to the tragedy are being debated in Spain, and one of them is the role companies should play to prevent putting employees at risk during natural disasters like this one. Daniel Patiño is a spokesperson in Valencia of Spain's largest union, Comisiones Obreras.
Some companies have empathized with the tragedy, but others have prioritized profits over workers' safety. That day, several companies didn't take any preventive measures and ignored weather alerts. That's a huge problem.
People have turned to social media to ask the government to ban economic activity when there are weather warnings. Is that necessary? Should it be the company or the government who decides to hold operations?
Our goal is to safeguard the public's health. Ideally, companies would make that decision themselves and enforce it strictly.
With the catastrophe hitting both employees and employers, tension at workplaces is on the rise, as we'll hear now from Fabian Leal, a Colombian electrician who lives in Alfafar, one of the worst hit areas.
I was living in the scene of a catastrophe, focused on solving local problems. To be honest, I disconnected from work, and I was also hurt because my boss never called to ask how my family was. I was on my way to help clean the church when my boss called me early on Monday morning. He asked why I wasn't at work. I reminded him that my neighborhood was affected by the floods, that my car had been completely destroyed, and that there were no trains or underground. He said, with bad manners, "Find a way. You need to be here or face the consequences." That made me angry. But my wife had lost her job in a real estate agency because her boss closed the company after the floods. So I was angry but also worried. I walked to my workplace. It took me almost 4 hours. When I got there, he said my shift started at 7, not at noon, so he didn't let me in. We had many fights and my case was on TV, making him look bad. In a nutshell, he hasn't fired me, but not because he doesn't want to fire me, but because that could bring him trouble.
Fabian's manager told the BBC he did say to his employee that he should have found a way to reach work, but that it happened in the heat of an argument. He said he has also lost everything. His house is covered in mud, and all of his company's tools and vehicles have been destroyed. This manager says that if Fabian had called a day earlier to say that he wasn't going to be able to go to work, he would have understood. Fabian is back at work now, but as they both admit, there's an open wound that will hardly heal.
That was Stefania Gazer reporting. And staying in Spain, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has announced another $4 billion worth of aid for the Valencia region nearly 2 weeks after those deadly floods. Okay. Have you ever dreamed of trying surfing but thought you were too old for it? Well, in Brazil, age is no barrier. This weekend, over 300 surfers aged 50 and above gathered in Santos, São Paulo, to attempt a world record for the most people riding the same wave. It's a growing trend, but also an expensive sport. So how do older surfers on fixed incomes make it work? Let's speak to John Walters, 69 years old surfer from Santos, Brazil. Hello, John.
Hello, Halloween. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to speak to you, John. I want to know, though, what's the real cost of riding the waves in your later years, and how do you do it when you're on a retirement budget?
Well, I would say, I've been surfing since I was 9 years old, since 1964. And when you have been surfing for many years, you have a quiver. In Santos, we have a very, very, I would say, peculiar situation, where it's very democratic to surf. We have a lot of small associations, a lot of schools. We have Cisco Arana, who has a public school. It's the Santos municipality that has it. But you can buy an old board for about $100, used one, and you can buy it for $1,000. So it depends a lot on your budget.
So essentially, you can kind of go for whatever is within your budget. So, I mean, how is that kind of in the economy, in your local economy, how has that sprung up new businesses? How has it even, you know, affected the community there?
Well, it has really factored so much into Brazil as a whole, but in Santos specifically, it's the first town of Brazil. The first surfer came here. He started surfing in 1937. The first woman started here. We have numerous world champions in surfing, in longboarding also. So Brazil has exploded. Back in the 60s when I started, it was very expensive to surf because we had to have boards from abroad, from the States, from California, Hawaii, and they were expensive.
Mm.
So what happened? So, yeah.
Yeah, no, you go ahead.
So what happened was that we had to make a lot of small garage shops and factories. So we learned how to shape, we learned how to glass the boards and everything. So it came naturally. Today you have a very big community of surfers in Santos and in Brazil. And this has really exploded the scene. Before, you only saw Santos, let's say, as a city of Pelé, the big football player, mm-hmm. who recently died, in the biggest port of Latin America. But today, Santos is also the port, the place where everything started. So it's a fantastic sport, and you have a lot of older people like me that still surf, and we have canoeing, we have stand-up paddling, we have many different forms of surfing, not only on a board. But the most important thing about this event is the fact that BlueMed, they are investing very much, let's say, in the elder group, the senior group. Because, I mean, the concept is very simple. The more you give sport to older people, the longer they live and healthy.
And my last question to you, John, what would you say to anyone who wants to start surfing and they're in their 60s who's listening now?
Well, I would say it's one of the best sports in the world. Once you get in touch with nature, you learn how to treat your health better, your body better, you will not stop surfing. If you can't come up on the board, then what do? You body surf, you swim.
All right. Well, John Walters, 69-year-old surfer from Santos, Brazil. Keep on riding those waves and keep in touch with us on World Business Report. And we appreciate you being here. And that's it from World Business Report team. Our producer today are Matt Lyons and Victoria Holland. Paul Lewis was on the tech today. Stephen Ryan is our editor, and I'm Leanna Byrne. Don't forget, a podcast of World Business Report is always available by searching for BBC World Business Report wherever you get your podcasts. And you can always email us at world.business@bbc.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening, and make sure to tune in to Business Matters coming up soon.